Man, thank you for those songs. We are going this morning to Romans chapter 14. So we have been going through the book of Romans in this sermon series. This is message number 66, entitled To Regard or Not Regard. We'll be looking at Romans chapter 14, verses 4 to 6. Who art thou that judgest another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth. Yea, he shall be holden up, for God is able to make him stand. One man esteemeth one day above another, another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. He that regardeth the day regardeth it unto the Lord, and he that regardeth not the day, to the Lord he doth not regard it. He that eateth to the Lord, for he giveth God thanks. And he that eateth not, to the Lord he eateth not, and giveth God thanks. So chapter 14 begins the second part of this last major section of the body of the Romans letter. And here Paul speaks more specifically to certain tensions in the Roman Christians were facing within the church or churches of Rome. Now, Paul is not so specific in these situations that we cannot see application beyond just those immediate concerns. For example, Paul doesn't frame the tensions, the problems that they were facing as a Jew-Gentile problem. Now, he does mention Jews and Gentiles a little later on, and certainly there would have been Jewish and Gentile tensions. But if Paul had framed this from the start as merely a Jew and Gentile problem, then we would more readily restrict the application of what he's saying to matters of Old Covenant law and matters of Jewish tradition. And Paul obviously is giving us application broader than that. It includes that, but it's not limited to that. Now, we often assume that such concerns as the eating of meats and the days and things that are talked about here, we oftentimes just assume that these concerns arise from debates about the Mosaic law. So within the first century churches where you had Jews in the membership along with Gentiles in the membership, there would be tensions between them concerning that, and ongoing even into our more modern times, there has persisted to be a problem and a debate among Christians about how to understand the law and how does the law apply and all of those sort of things. So generally we see these kind of tensions in regard to debates about the Old Covenant law. But what we have to realize is that ascetic practices have an ancient history among cultures and religions as part of their philosophies. Now, this was certainly true of the Greco-Roman world in the first century. Asceticism refers generally to the abstinence from physical pleasures such as eating meat. And this was typically done for some spiritual purposes, whether it would be for the pursuit of enlightenment or the pursuit of self-mastery or the pursuit of purity. Whatever, there could be various reasons, but the point is that restrictive practices and even severe self-disciplines have been present among all different kinds of cultures, all different kinds of religions, all different kinds of philosophies. So it's not only Jews that were brought up in some sort of restrictive way with the Old Covenant law. In other words, so Paul, as he speaks about this issue, he doesn't frame it in terms of the Mosaic law because it has application well beyond that. So we tend to think of the Romans and the problems of the Gentiles as being all problems of excess and all problems of indulgence and these gluttonous parties and feasts and things. That's typically what we think about as being the problem with the Romans. And those certainly did exist, but the opposite extreme also existed. In other words, you had people who were thoroughly pagan, who also practiced very severe ascetic practices for whatever reasons they had for practicing, sometimes religious, sometimes otherwise. But regardless of that, that did exist in the Gentile world, completely uninfluenced by Old Covenant law. So again, I think that's why that Paul does not frame these issues in terms of Old Covenant law or in terms of Jewish and Gentile problems, because they're certainly not limited to that. And what he has to say applies beyond just those sorts of debates. Now, the three issues in this part that Paul addresses are the eating of meat or not eating of meat. In other words, a more, I guess, what we might call a vegetarian diet. Observing special days or not observing special days. And the drinking of wine or the not drinking of wine. All of these things are in this particular chapter. Now, 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 that we talked about last time has some similarities and also has some differences with this passage that help shed some light on it. So there is a category for actions for Christians, things that God has neither commanded nor has He prohibited. And we ended up calling those just simply permissible things. So there are things that God has commanded that we must do. There are things that God has prohibited or He has forbidden that we must not do. And then there is another category of things that are permissible things. These are things that we can do. We may do them, we may not do them, but they are things that are permissible. So for example, prayer is commanded. That's something that we are commanded to do by the Bible. We are to pray to God. Murder is something that is prohibited by the Bible. That is something that we are not to do because it is wrong. Eating meat, however, is permissible. We can do it or we cannot do it. Either way, it is permissible. So permissible means that Christians have the liberty, and this is the way that it came to be talked about in terms of theology or biblical doctrine. You've heard of the doctrine of Christian liberty or soul liberty or something along that line. This is the way that it came to be talked about over time amongst the churches. Permissible means that Christians have the liberty or they have the freedom to do these things or to abstain from doing these things. And doing them or not doing them doesn't, in other words, let me restate this. Christians have the liberty to do or to not do certain things as long as these are things, again, not commanded or prohibited, and that the doing of them or the not doing of them, whatever the case may be, doesn't obscure or contradict the gospel. And see, if you look at the letters to the Galatians as well as the letters to the Colossians, you will also find Paul dealing with some very similar things as to here in Romans 14. But again, you're going to notice some key differences. The problems in the churches in Galatia as well as the Colossae church were problems where the gospel was being contradicted. The gospel was being obscured. The gospel was being affected by what was being done and not done and what was being taught and such. So Paul responds very differently there than what he does here in Romans 14. Now, verses 1 to 3 that we covered the last time introduce this part. This last main section has two main parts, and this is the second. So it introduces this part, and it gives us really, in these first three verses, it gives us Paul's basic argument that he makes throughout this chapter and into chapter 15, where this part and this whole section comes to an end. He describes here the people who are in tension with one another as being weak on the one hand and strong on the other hand. Now, he doesn't use the term strong until later, but that obviously is the implication. Weak and strong here are describing their consciences. And I know that he says weak in faith, and we talked about that. And again, 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 and the full context of this part. He's obviously talking about their consciences, having a weak conscience or having a strong conscience. The strong conscience has knowledge and understanding of freedoms that we do have. The weak are restricted by a less understanding of those freedoms. So he starts out by saying the strong are to receive or to welcome the weak, not to despise them, not to endlessly dispute with them about these things. And on the other hand, he says the weak are not to judge or condemn the strong. So as Paul uses the terms weak and strong, and he uses these same terms in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, and he uses them the same way there, those who are weak are living by stricter standards than those who are strong. And again, that's consistent between both of those passages. So he says, the strong are not to despise the weak, and the weak are not to condemn the strong. Now, this welcoming language to receive or to welcome that Paul uses throughout shows that his primary concern, again, is within a local church body. Now, we should be informed also, as we see in these first three verses, we should also be informed in this problem by the greater reality that God has received or welcomed both. The one who eats the meat and the one who doesn't eat the meat. Paul says we should receive or welcome each other as brothers and sisters in Christ because God has received us both. So now we are looking at verses 4 to 6. And these verses continue now and speak to this second issue and that of observing special days. Now, Paul addresses the problem of observing days in the same basic way that he did the problem of eating meat or not eating meat in the first three verses. In fact, he refers again to eating meat in this passage, bringing it along with the same category as the observing of special days. Paul also fills in more of the description of permissible activities or of the liberties that Christians have. So a Christian has the liberty to do these things and can honor God in doing them. A Christian also has the liberty to not do these things and can also honor God in not doing them. So we want to look at verses 4 to 6 regarding days, beginning with verse number 4. Who art thou that judgest another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth. Yea, he shall be holden up, for God is able to make him stand. So Paul opens up here with a rhetorical question, and that directly addresses the hearer. Who art thou? Who are you that judgest another man's servant? Now he had just written in verse number 3 that the strong are not to despise the weak, and that the weak are not to judge the strong. And so the you that he speaks to here, or the thou that he speaks to, is obviously encompassing both the weak and the strong. And ultimately, as we go through this passage, we're going to see that primarily Paul continues to say the same things to the weak and to the strong in regard to each other. So obviously he's encompassing both sides here, though he specifically spoke of the weak as judging, but it parallels the despising of the strong. So he's saying the same things to both sides. Now, Paul uses this same word for judge, and the word means to distinguish or to discern between. It's a word that does have a legal connotation of of condemning or of judging to be guilty in that sense. And Paul uses this very same word in that 1 Corinthians passage. In fact, it appears in chapter 10 and verse number 29. And verses 29 and 30 there say, "Conscience, I say, not thine own, but of the other. For why is my liberty judged of another man's conscience?" And that's where he uses the same word there. But then notice what he says in verse 30. "For if I by grace be a partaker," in other words, if he's eating of the meat, "why am I evil spoken of for that for which I give thanks?" Now remember, the issue in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 is primarily that of eating meat that has been sacrificed to idols. Paul clearly said that he had the strength to be able to eat that meat. And there was nothing inherently sinful or wrong with that meat in itself and eating it. And so if he had the strong conscience that by grace he could eat that meat and give thanks to God, he says, "Why should I be judged by another man's conscience," which in this case would be the weaker conscience? And then he says, of that judgment, he describes it as being evil spoken of for what he has given thanks. In other words, he associates this judgment with evil speaking. Now, the word for evil speaking that appears there in 1 Corinthians 10 is the word for blasphemy. It's where we get our word, our English word blasphemy from, the word in the Greek. So it's the word for blasphemy. And it means, in this context, it means slandering, or we could say falsely accusing. So Paul is saying that judgment here would involve accusing a person of wrongdoing, accusing a person of sinning. Paul is saying, if I, with a strong and clear conscience, can eat this meat, why am I being accused of wrong for eating it? And it's a false accusation, is obviously the point that Paul is getting at. So judging, when he says to not judge him that eateth, and then asks the question, who are you that's judging another man's servant? This judging that he's talking about is condemning something as sinful that God does not condemn as sinful. And in the extreme, it could even refer to judging a person to be ungodly or even unsaved because they are doing something that God does not condemn as sinful. So that's what Paul asks in this question. Who art thou that judgest who accuses another man's servant of wrong? Now he casts this whole question, he puts it in the terms of a master-slave relationship. Now, the slave obviously was responsible to serve and to please his own master. And obviously, relying on the Roman concept and institution of slavery as it existed, which is typically when we hear the word slave or master, we only think of the chattel form of slavery. I'm not saying that that didn't exist at all, but there was also a more formal form of slavery that we might consider to be a bond slave or a debt, the repayment of a debt, selling yourself into slavery to repay a debt, and it could be born into it, and other sort of things. I mean, there was a very well-defined class structure within the Roman society, but nevertheless, the slave, as Paul is appealing to this slave and master image. The slave was responsible to his own master and answered to his own master. And in that day, under that governing authority, that master had control and power and authority over that slave. So Paul's question here, and it's certainly put in the way of reproof. Paul's question here is, who are you to condemn another man's slave? Now, the rebuke comes from the implication that when you judge or condemn another, You've made yourself master over them. So Paul uses this imagery. When you condemn another, you've made yourself to be the master over them, made them out to be the slave to you, so as they have to answer to you to please you. So the question is, who are you to do that? Who are you to do that? And that's the way that Paul puts it. In other words, what right do you have to make yourself master over another man's slave? What right do you have to do that? Now, obviously, in the context of what Paul is saying, if a weak conscience is used to judge a strong conscience, or vice versa, then that conscience is made master over the other conscience, or is made to be the standard of judgment over other consciences. So Paul responds to that implication by stating the obvious truth. To his own master he standeth or falleth. A slave is judged by his own master. He stands or he falls, or in other words, he pleases or he displeases his own master. The implication is that he stands or falls, obviously, by his own master's judgment. Now, from that general principle about slaves and masters, Paul makes a specific application. And he says, yea, he shall be holden up, for God is able to make him stand. So he's illustrated this general principle from the world of slaves and masters, and now he's making a specific application to the tensions being faced by these Christians in Rome. The Christian who eats meat and the Christian who doesn't eat meat will not fall before his own master, who is Christ, for eating the meat or not eating the meat. So what does he do? He gives us another instance of appealing to a greater theological reality. What does he say? He says, God is able to make him stand. So God receives both, he has told us, and now he's telling us that God makes both to stand before him. So the weak is not more or less received, nor is he more or less standing before the Lord than the strong. I'm going to paraphrase a remark that John Piper made about this, that the weakest Christian of all time will stand before Christ just as justified and just as accepted as the strongest Christian of all time. So as Paul is looking at this tension between those eating meat and those not eating meat, he appeals to this greater reality. You are slaves of a master, which is not one another, but is Jesus Christ. And you will stand before Christ. You will be accepted by Christ the same as the weak and the strong. Then we go to verse 5. One man esteemeth one day above another, another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. So now Paul shifts to this other area of tension for the Roman Christians, and that was the observation of certain days. Now, just like with the eating of the meat, he frames this tension with two opposing actions. One man sees certain days as special times that are to be observed. You'll notice, Paul here does not indicate that he's thinking specifically or only of Jewish days, such as feasts and fasts and Sabbaths and what have you. He doesn't say that. Now, those would obviously be included, And they may have even been the primary concern at this time that was at tension. May have been. But Paul doesn't put it that way. And obviously he doesn't do that, I believe, for a reason, as we have talked about a number of times. So it is not limited to only these Jewish concern about days. He says one person observes these special days and another does not observe those special days. He sees every day being alike and he doesn't see any need to observe them. In other words, he has the freedom not to observe these days. And then Paul issues the admonition that every man must be fully convinced in his own mind. Now, this shows us that on the one hand, Paul doesn't say this concern is unimportant. He doesn't say that the tensions that can arise over meats and over days is, you know, just a trivial matter and just, you know, forget about it and just, you know, just go on with life. He doesn't put it that way. And in fact, I'm sure he had knowledge. And if you've been around churches and Christians very long, then you've also had experience that oftentimes it is these kind of things that cause the divisions and the schisms and the splits and the splinters and all of the fractures that take place that bring churches down. A lot of times it's these things, or these things greatly contribute to that fall. There haven't been a lot of times and a lot of church splits I've personally known about, for instance, that have actually occurred over some important matter of doctrine, some important point of truth that is taught in the Scripture. Oftentimes, it is much more over these kinds of tensions. So in other words, they have the potential. They have the potential to cause great rifts between those who are brothers and sisters in Christ, who Paul says should look at one another with love, with patience, with welcoming, with receiving, should be able to cooperate and fellowship together, should be able to, with one mind and one mouth, glorify God, even though they've made some different decisions in some of these areas. So he is showing us here when he says this, that he doesn't take this as just an unimportant, trivial matter, that there's just really nothing to be said about it. We should just ignore it and move on, or everybody should just, or just, you know, just have everybody to agree to do this one thing and then go on. He doesn't handle it that way. He says, let every man be persuaded, fully persuaded, to be fully convinced, he says, in his own mind. In fact, he uses the same word when he's talking about Abraham's faith back in Romans chapter 4. Abraham was fully convinced. That's what he says. Let every man be fully convinced, fully persuaded in his own mind. That he says every man and his own mind points to the fact that Paul is acknowledging that we each have to make these decisions regarding our own actions in this realm of permissible things. We're going to have to think those things out, think our context and our situation, and we're going to have to reason those things out, apply the principles from Scripture that we have, and we're going to have to come to decisions about these kind of things, of what we're going to do and not going to do. Now, Paul used the language in 1 Corinthians 10:23, where he said, all things are lawful to me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful to me, but all things edify not. So he used the language of lawful and expedient and edifying there. And he's using it in a similar way as what we see occurring in this passage, but I do think that his purpose in these passages is a little different. Here in Romans, he's stressing that we do not have the right or the authority to regulate another person's conscience before God, and that we must come to these decisions seeking first to please God, who is our own master. In other words, He is the one before whom we stand or fall. And I mean that each of us individually. And we have to make these kinds of decisions based first and foremost on pleasing Him with our lives. And then we come to verse number 6. He that regardeth the day, regardeth it unto the Lord. And he that regardeth not the day, to the Lord he doth not regard it. He that eateth, eateth to the Lord, for he giveth God thanks. And he that eateth not, to the Lord he eateth not, and giveth God thanks. So here Paul makes an application to days and meats of what he has said. This statement seems paradoxical. I mean, verse number 6 seems like that it can't, both of these can't be simultaneously true. And actually, as I've been going through Romans 14, I have been reminded more than once of a conversation that I had one time with a man who had been my Sunday school teacher. And I was, when I was younger, he had been my Sunday school teacher. And I was very frustrated over a conflict that I was having with someone else. And I'm talking to this man about it. And he took me to Romans 14. And I was exasperated. How could this be possible? You are suggesting that I and this other person who are having this conflict could do such different things and both be right. Oh, I was so frustrated and so exasperated by him telling me that. Of course, over time, I came to see that my former teacher was right about what he was saying about that situation. And that is exactly what Paul is telling us here. So again, it feels paradoxical. It feels contradictory, but Paul is showing us that it is not. So the weak one here, by implication, the weak one here regards certain days as being set aside to the Lord in some way. And again, Paul's not specific enough about that for us to restrict it to certain things. Could be a fast, could be a feast, could be something else. And in doing so, in regarding these days, Paul says he's doing it to the Lord. In other words, he does have a good intention, and he does have a good motivation that he is doing this to the Lord. Regarding it to the Lord means that he is honoring and serving the Lord in doing it, and that he thinks that it's good and that he should do it in some way or for some reason. Obviously not for salvation, or Paul would be talking about this very differently. And from the previous verse, we can also say that this one that is regarding the day, that's doing it to the Lord, that he's pleasing the Lord and he's accepted by the Lord. In other words, he's standing before the Lord. That's what Paul has told us. Well, the strong one, on the other hand, in this verse, is the one that does not observe these days. And Paul says he doesn't regard the day to the Lord. So this one, the strong one here, understands the liberty that he has in Jesus Christ, that God does not require him to observe these days. Again, whatever that they are. And so if we're following through with, as Paul does, he's saying that this one that's not regarding the days, he is honoring the Lord. He's serving the Lord by not regarding the days. And again, he pleases the Lord and is accepted. He stands before the Lord in not doing it. Well, then Paul says the very same thing about the eating of meat. In other words, it's obviously the same category. The eating of meat and the not eating of meat. One eats and eats to the Lord and gives thanks for the meat, and another doesn't eat, and he does that to the Lord, and he gives thanks. Well, the giving of thanks here at the latter part of verse number 6 is a part of what is considered praising the Lord. So in other words, Paul's adding here to his description. We have seen this especially as we have been looking at the Psalms. The word praise and thanksgiving are so closely related. So we say then that these both, because they're doing it to the Lord, and because they're giving thanks, or because they're praising God in what they're doing, that they are honoring, praising, and glorifying the Lord. So Paul has told us that different Christian people doing these differing and opposing actions are both pleasing God in those actions. And while it may not appear so immediately, Paul is here making another statement of greater theological reality. Both Christians, in doing these opposing actions, are glorifying God and are accepted by Him. Now, from the full context of Paul's argument, we can understand how that can be, because they are honoring God in two drastically different actions, because they're each doing what they're doing from good motives and from a clear conscience. Now, that's a little later on, what we're not getting to today. But again, keeping this full context in mind, we can understand how Paul can say that these two can be doing such different actions and yet both be giving thanks and both be doing it to the Lord. Well, growing up in restrictive contexts trains our consciences to view certain activities or objects as right or wrong, inherently good or bad. And growing up in certain cultural and religious contexts trains the conscience to see, for instance, the eating of meat, of all meat, as an abomination. And a vegetarian diet, in that sense, would be seen as virtuous. There are some cultures and religions that don't forbid all meats, but only certain meats, like pork. And again, that's more than just Judaism. Well, the point is that that sort of rigid training of the conscience can be difficult to overcome. And I do believe that's would be one reason that Paul is especially talking to the strong and exhorting the strong to be loving and to be patient and to be welcoming of the weak. Now, the training or the recalibrating of the conscience is included in the renewing of our minds that needs to happen continually. In other words, Paul will ultimately in this passage side with the strong, just like he does in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. And by implication, he doesn't want the weak to remain weak. However, he does recognize the existence of both, and we could say even those that are in all variations in between, in the same church body. And so the exhortation here is focused on the mindset of love that we should have for each other and the unity that we should have in glorifying God. And from the start, we should recognize that we are justified and accepted in Jesus Christ by faith apart from our works. And our fellow believers who may see these permissible actions differently than we do are not less justified or less accepted in Jesus Christ by God than we are. I do believe that's Paul's primary point. All right, and that's all of the message this morning. We will close with a hymn.